Okay, Caleb, you ready?
Yeah, I'm ready.
You guys are having deep theological conversations back there, I know. Okay, we're going to jump in. I appreciate everybody coming tonight. We tried to cool the room down a little bit, and tonight we're going to build on what we talked about last night. A little bit of a recap, though, for those who may not have been here for the whole thing last night. Our focus is not trying to take churches that are reaching millennials and asking the question, what are they doing that we can do? But rather trying to think through what they are. What is it about them in their essence? So the idea of this definition, the essence of a thing, is the Urban Dictionary's definition of ethos. And I like this story. Tell them how ethos got its name. This is really a fascinating story.
Yeah, this is really, really funny, comical, I guess. But ethos was just meeting and just being in church, and we were just being, in a way, very organic. Also because we had no concrete location. And so the first concrete thing about the church was a website, actually, as we're getting older and branding ourselves. And so the kind of the church leaders were sitting around saying, okay, we need a website. People have to be able to type something in, you know, so you have to have actually a title for a website. You have to have somewhere to go, www.what. And so they were all sitting around thinking, what are we? Well, someone was drinking the ethos water that you'd buy at Starbucks. And if you've ever been drinking this water, it's fascinating because they have a great mission statement on the other side of the big brand. And it says, simply put, a group of people that gather around one purpose. Mm-hmm. So they're trying to figure out what's the website. Someone reads it, and they said, that sounds great to us. So Ethos was born.
What is the website, by the way, for Ethos? Do you know?
Yeah, it's ethoschurch.org.
Ethoschurch.org. Okay, so.
And so, well, so to connect the, it's, so Ethos, you could call anything, is in Ethos Home, Ethos House, the Ethos Goldmans.
Yeah.
So Ethos Church would be a center of people gathered around a church.
Yeah.
Or God.
So I wanted us to think critically a little bit about how we end up where we are. Established churches all exist as church plants that made it. Now let's make sure we catch that. Established churches, 100% of all established churches, are church plants that made it. If you're planting a church, would you rather it make it or die? Everybody would rather it make it, right? So every established church that you look at today that maybe we've become critical of, or we look at and we kind of start looking at judgmentally, is a church plant that effectively made it. I work at a church plant that is in its 115th year. That's a way to look at it. Another way to look at it is it's an established church. Ethos is currently still being looked at as a church plant or a new church. But at some point, it ceases to be a church plant and simply is an established church. Your only alternative is to die, right? So before we become too critical, and I hear this word thrown around a lot about established churches, well, the only alternative is death. So at some point, you want your church plant to become an established church. Now, every established church has practices that also were originally strategic. And this is vital for us to remember. For example, if you were to take any kind of church schedule that a church has, it at one point was strategic. A church name at one point was strategic. The problem comes is when something that started as strategic simply becomes habit and now no longer has any value at all, or we're holding on to it despite its inefficiencies. Mm-hmm. And I want to tell a story to illustrate this from a church that I just love, 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 love. And that's the Cordova Church of Christ in Sacramento. Spent most of it, I won't be able to have a career anywhere else like I've had there because of the length of that time. The church there, their senior citizens had a ministry that they got together and they were asking, what can we do to help our missions in Africa? They really supported the Ethiopian work of Bahailu Abebe. And so they began to process, what can we do to help? They had two profession printers in the church. And they had this World Bible School and World English Institute materials that Bahailu Abebe said, this would be great if we could get this translated into Amharic. So they translated into Amharic, and they bought a full-scale printing press, and the senior citizens of that church were every week going to go down there for 9 months a year, and they were going to print WBS and WEI materials in Amharic, then ship them over to Ethiopia. Now, the problem with shipping things to Ethiopia is the people who control the harbors, they believe everything in every shipping container has monetary value or it wouldn't have been shipped in the first place. So the way that they make their money is by bribes. And the way they get bribes is by holding up shipping containers for, well, as long as they want to, until said person, said recipient, decides to up the bribe. So they begin to bribe the Ethiopian churches over there to the tune of $2,000 to $3,000 to just as the bribe plus the shipping costs to get it out of the port. So Bahailu, this great missionary, he basically says, you know, logically speaking, what we should do is buy a printing press in Ethiopia. And then we can train Ethiopians. You guys can come over and train them how to print, how to cut and fold. And if you look at it, it'll be far less expensive to print in Ethiopia. Plus, you're giving some Ethiopians a job. And on top of that, we don't have to get it out of customs at all. So that made logical sense. Bought the printing press, got it over there, doing it. The Americans, though, were frustrated. Some of them just flat out angry. You stole our ministry. Now, how many of you agree logically for it to be printed in Ethiopia makes sense, right? 100% of us. But if you're the one who was doing that ministry as part of your strategic mission, when that gets taken from you, you feel stripped down. You feel stolen from. You feel robbed. This could be said about so many ministries. Bus ministry. How many of you remember the old bus ministry? You couldn't pull off a bus ministry if you wanted to today. Nobody's going to put their kids on a bus unless they just simply want to get rid of them. And then you need to be asking who's putting their kids on our bus. Right? Bus ministries, they were effective for a time. They're out. Puppet ministries were very effective for a time. And then they're out. And I guess that they'll probably recycle. Mm-hmm. They'll probably recycle because there's a ministry. There's a college, one of the Christian, independent Christian churches, has this puppet ministry that are like puppet ministry on steroids. And every year this church puts on this puppet show for Christmas. And apparently in the town that they're in, they sell out every night, 5 nights leading up to Christmas. They do this big puppet thing. Good for them. But one of the things we have to keep in mind is that things must always change. So let's start there tonight, Caleb. We're talking about the mentality between maintenance and marching.
Well, I'm also thinking that the funny thing about the whole phrase, well, we all know, is if you're not growing, you're dying. And yeah. I grew up all my life in church. For some reason, that was a really bad phrase. I don't know if you guys have that feeling also, because we didn't want to be a church about people or numbers. Have you ever heard that? Like, mm-hmm. And we're not going to be a church about numbers. We're fine wherever we're at. We're going to do it. Well, the fun thing about being part of a church plant is we really care about the numbers. Why? Because if we don't care about the numbers, we're dead. That's just because we're so small. Ethos is a little bit larger at this point, but the mentality is still within our hearts. So we're still driving, how do we get more people? And I think a lot of this conversation, too, goes to the point, are you trying to get numbers for numbers' sake, or are you trying to get numbers because your heart is to gain the lost? So the more numbers in your church means the more lost people that have been found, the more people that are coming in. So that's the goal of everything. Our goal, one of our goals in Ethos is to make disciples and to plant churches. Very simple, because planting more churches means there's more lost people who have known Christ. Making more disciples means there are more people who now know Christ and know Him better. So we want to make disciples and plant churches. So we always try to be fluid. So one of our phrases is that we only have five close-handed disciplines or theologies. We believe in God. We believe in Jesus Christ, in baptism, in the Spirit, in the church. was that five or six? That was five. All the rest is fluid. We will change for the sake of gaining the nation, of gaining the world. If one location that we meet in doesn't seem to be gaining lost people, then we'll just leave it. But why stay there? But we're also young, so we don't have the backlash of people who are used to old locations.
I was looking for a marker. We don't have a marker in here, so just visualize with me. that you're in an army and you're on the march, okay? There are things that have to happen to get from that wall to that wall. Let's say that that's your destination. So once the army moves to this point, there's a legitimacy to saying we're going to leave a camp of our soldiers in this point to do what?
Maintain,
to establish the territory, right? We've taken this far. We're not going to relinquish. Now, the army is going to continue pressing on, but we need a contingent here that's holding this territory and then moving on. Now, some people are more wired to constantly move. Who's that in the room? How many of you are more wired to constantly move? That's me. How many of you are more wired to camp? Okay, a lot of you there, and some of you are, it's too late to give complex analogies. I get that. Okay, so if we're marching, though, we need to talk about marching mode versus maintenance mode. And we have some things here that just to talk about. If you're maintaining a camp, then you're concerned with protecting. That's one of the first things you're concerned with. You're also concerned about fixing and repairing and about limiting your risk. These all go hand in hand with being a group that is thinking about maintaining, protecting, cleaning, fixing, preparing, and we might say playing it safe or limiting risk. Now, if you're marching, it's a different mentality. You have a destination in mind, and you're going there. So, yeah, you're fixing things, but why are you fixing things?
It's broken, it won't be.
Yeah, so you keep marching, right? So you're fixing things so you keep marching. You're destination driven. We're going to get there. And the cool thing about being in the army of God is you actually never reach your destination. So you're always pressing. And your fixes come in motion, and you are calculating your risks. It's not that you're just taking risks for risk's sake, but you're taking calculated risks. Now, this idea of motion came to me in a very real way when I got to visit the Boeing plant in what they call the world's largest building to see how the new 787 Dreamliner is being built. And what's interesting is when they bring in the fuselage to start the work, it starts at the end of this plant, and it's put on a conveyor, and the 787, and for that matter, all the jets being made and manufactured in Boeing, never stop until they leave the warehouse. Once it enters the warehouse, it's put on that constant motion conveyor. So if you're working on those planes, you're working on a moving vessel. And it just, you can see it paced as it's going through the assembly line. And when it gets to the end of the assembly line, what does it do? It goes out and it takes off and it flies. That's what it's designed to do. And we would be better off thinking of the church in that metaphor than being an established fortified city. Yeah.
They learned from Ford, didn't they?
They learned from Ford. That's right. I didn't want to give Ford credit, but they absolutely did learn from that. So that's one of the things that we would say is a core value of these churches that are doing well with reaching multi-generations is they are constantly in motion, and change and motion does not offend. Listen, change and motion. Except now those five things, what were they again?
There are God and Christ, Spirit, baptism, and church.
And church. Those five things. Everything else is absolutely fluid and is going to change.
And if I could say, yeah, too, another way to think about this is that as a church, we always have to do, we react and we innovate. We have to innovate as we're talking about and changing and marching because the world around us changes. It's all, our whole language is that the church is the separation between God and the world. So the world's always changing. God is, you know, the Omega before and now and will be forever. So he is almost like a fixed figure. The church has got to be somewhat of both. So we're always reacting. And ministers, you know what I mean when you say we react to a lot of things because, I mean, your church, in your church, there are things we just have to react to. It's what's called being a pastor. But there are also things that we've got to innovate. So a great example of this in Ethos is we do our house church system. And so Dave loves to tell a story that within 2 years, we had 20 house churches. First year, we had 8. Second year, we had over 16. So times 2. But so you're like, how do you do such big growth? As in 200 times. Imagine your church doubled in a year. And so Dave loves to tell stories that he found someone that he didn't necessarily know super well, but he felt that they were going to be a great church leader someday, which is a great heart. We could just, I mean, that's a great heart. So he took this person he doesn't know very well, but he knows, hey, this person has a heart for the Lord. I want you to be a church leader. This is how you do it. He set him up, and he said, let's go. So 3 years in, he said he has now 10 house churches and over 20 house churches that fell apart. And so by year three, he realized, I'm a marcher, and I need a pastor. So then he got his great friend who would pastor those churches, and then they had 15 and only two closed down, and now we're marching and pastoring.
Yeah, you got to keep that in mind. So let's talk about the hot button issue. The biggest one when it comes to this is worship. Okay, worship is always in motion. Let me rephrase that. Worship always has to be in motion. By nature, worship cannot settle. Because worship, if it settles, what does it become immediately? Boring. Okay, that's... Thank you for somebody older and wiser saying that one. It can become boring. It becomes irrelevant.
Yeah.
At the moment that worship stands still, it by nature becomes irrelevant. It becomes a thing of the past. Hymn writers don't want their songs to be sung only after they're dead. They would like those songs to be sung while they're alive. Think about Ken Young tonight leading Faithful Love. I'm sure his heart swells to hear a congregation of 2,000, 3,000 people sing Faithful Love. He wrote that song. Think about Randy Gill singing the song he wrote, Shout Hallelujah. Now, would those guys like those songs to live past their own lives? I'm sure they would. But you don't want to die and only then have your songs be sung. So worship is always going to change, and it has changed from the very beginning of time. Hymnals were the first big controversial technology that really began to split the church. Alexander Campbell did not think notes should ever be printed in a hymnal. It was the words only that should be there. But there's some people committed to four-part harmony. So there's all these arguments going on about four-part harmony. And then came the big debate over shape notes versus regular notes. I love people walking into our church and seeing our hymnals, and they would go, what are all these weird shapes that you have? That was my growing up. You know, what are all these strange? And my dad could sing shape notes. It is so complex to me. I can't figure out why. I didn't get a college degree to sing shape notes. Dan, you sing shape notes?
Yeah.
All right. Look around. There's some people that understand shape notes. God bless you.
It's the same thing, though, if people don't understand them. It's written in its own language.
Right. It's its own language. So just that is an illustration. You know, projectors. Projectors, projecting up either words or music or both. All of this is innovation that takes place. Now what's happening is the biggest push right now in Churches of Christ is a lot of Churches of Christ that are going instrumental and a cappella at the same time. And people don't know what to do with that. I will just tell you this side of working in both kinds of congregations is that this is something that we need to not get overstimulated about. We need to understand it. Now, worship leaders... Well, your worship leader is leading worship and organizing worship at a rather large congregation quite successfully. And tell them a little bit about your worship leader.
Well, it's funny because I want to say two things involved. One being that our worship is incredible. Ashley and I can attest that. It's been a blessing to get to worship with just really high-quality worship. As in, I mean, even for you, yes, we have instruments, but more so... If you know that the quality of a singer, the quality of a worship leader, someone that can just lead you, and you just want to follow them, and your heart goes with them, he's incredible. So you think, man, where did he get his study? Where did he get his origin? You know, where did this great musician be found? Well, come to find out, he didn't grow up ever leading. He was found in a college dorm room with a guitar sitting in his dorm. So our church leader said that he was the campus minister and found this kid who was a freshman and said, hey, let's have lunch. So he got to know the kid. He said, hey, I like you. Let's go on a mission trip. So the kid, and then this kid says, hey, I like playing guitar. You think it'd be all right if I tried leading worship for us a couple times? He says, of course, try it. And then, boom, he said their worship on this mission trip led nothing else. Like, the worship made the mission trip something else. And so now we have the same kid who's now our worship leader. And from the start, someone saying, hey, I believe in you, and you have a gift, he has become one of our, I mean, his worship is unreal. What does he do, though, with his time is he works really hard to learn how to be a better worship leader. I guess because he never came from thinking that he was something. He's always trying to develop. But two, he works on gaining more worship leaders. I guess because he remembers that time when someone else says, hey, I believe in you and think that you can be a worship leader. So they do frequent tryouts to say, hey, we need more worship leaders, so let's see the quality. And so I want to encourage you, if you're in a church, you probably have really great gifted people in your church. They just need an opportunity, someone like seeking them out. Mm-hmm. At the same time, it's a flip of the coin. You don't. That does not mean you have to say, anyone who wants to sing can sing, because you want some gift, and you want to find it. So it's a flip of the coin. It takes some discernment. Let your worship leader discern that and lead that. But it's been awesome to see the worship leaders that will kind of be birthed out of this innovative, hey, let's have really high quality worship from within our church. Let's not outsource and say, where can we hire someone who's already become great?
So some things that I'm learning about listening to these churches that do this well, and they bring people in, here's some things that I've come up with that I'm pretty convicted of. It is not that if you play it, they will come. Okay, hear me say that. I'm in an instrumental church. It's not if you play it, they will come. I can tell you this, though. If you play it poorly, they won't come back. Okay? This I'm sure of. If you're going to sing it modern, you know, we've got a worship pastor here. You can sing it great. If you sing it poorly, they won't come back. And that's a cultural thing, and you need to understand that. Is quality in music is a cultural thing. And in Churches of Christ, we have a big argument over participation versus professionalism. We really have a big debate about this. And so the story I like to tell is about a young man that was in my youth ministry in Livermore. I got there, I moved out there, and I have this lack of filter sometimes on saying things, and I don't know if it's good or bad. Things just come out. So this young man was just constantly invited to lead worship for the church. And I couldn't figure this out because the kid's tone deaf. And so one day I'm talking to him. I said, hey, Desmond. I said, why do you lead singing all the time? He said, because I'm a really good worship leader. And I said, well, you're tone deaf. He goes, well, I don't know what that means. I said, you can't hear music. When you're singing, you sing the same note. It doesn't move up and down. Well, as a tone deaf person, he didn't know music was supposed to go up and down. He just does. But all these little ladies in the church kept coming up to him saying, oh, you're so good. You're so good. He was horrible. Absolutely horrible. A tone deaf person should not lead worship. Can we all agree on that? But we don't want to state that. We don't want to accept that. So all these people got mad at me. They're like, how dare you tell him he's tone deaf? You know, you're supposed to protect him. Amen. So I'm protecting the church. So I grabbed him one day and I said, here's what I want you to do. In a few Sunday nights, we're doing youth night, and I want you to do the devotional thought. So he gets up, and he leads this devotional thought that was phenomenal. I can remember it still to this day. His tagline or his punchline in there was, but isn't it possible to be sincerely wrong? When he said that, you could have heard a pin drop. Now, at the end of that conversation, people came up and said to him, where have you been? Man, and where he had been is misaligned with his giftedness. Because the church was protecting somebody who was not gifted in one area. It is okay, hear me, it is okay and necessary for the church that's serious about reaching a lost world and reaching the younger generations to admit that somebody is not musically talented and should not be up there leading worship. I remember being in church, we had one guy, I won't mention names, you know, every little boy that goes to church camp, Church of Christ, learns the 4-4, learns the 3-4, learns the J-6-8, and those of us who are really advanced can do the double 4-4, right? Yeah, I mean, we're rocking the house. One guy just knew you're supposed to do something with your hand, so he did this for every song. I called it the wax on, wax off move. You know, he didn't know what he's doing, but he knew you're supposed to move your hand somehow. So he did that. Oh, my goodness. Stop and put people who are gifted in the right gift set using their talents and their abilities. When the wrong people in the wrong place at the wrong time, I guarantee you, the right person who should be in that right place at the right time doesn't get a chance.
And
yeah, go ahead.
Well, if I could encourage, too, that for you in church leadership, and you who are part of the church, you're a leader standing because you know the Lord. We are meant to lead. And one thing that I've really learned from my church environment that I've really appreciated is a few things. One that we hear often is that hard words produce soft hearts. Soft words produce hard hearts. So, for example, when you're constantly just being kind to someone, saying, hey, you're great, you're amazing, well, then what else are they supposed to think about themselves? I mean, they're amazing. What else? I mean, they've been filled with that grace, and they've never had any type of challenge. And also, they have no type of reality of who they are. How are you supposed to know if you're tone deaf unless someone tells you? And no one wants to be hard. But those hard words, if you think about it in your own life, that's when it produces some different path of direction for you that's closer towards reality. And another thing is that we in our church, we've got to have both a challenging culture and a grace-filled culture. And what I mean by that is, I mean, only that challenge is what drives us to march on forward. But it's only that grace that tells us, hey, we are good at who we are. You know, it gives us that encouragement, that heart. So especially in this worship type setting, our worship leader oftentimes brings someone along with them. And he tries to figure out, okay, how can I always give them the reality where they're at, yet express to them where they're at? As in, hey, right now you're not where you're going to be. Right now you are still kind of struggling. Right now you've got these weaknesses, and you need to be aware of them. But he says oftentimes he's always trying to encourage them, let them know, also, right now you are leading people because of your heart for the Lord. If we don't have those words in every conversation, then we're either going to have someone that hates us because it's too challenging, or someone that has no direction because it's just too grace-filled, and they're just loved.
City Church now has about 7 campuses, so many services I can't keep track of, about 20,000 people. And I went to City Church a few months ago. Some of our young people who go there on Sunday evening, they mainly go there to meet Russell Wilson. They all want to meet the Seahawks quarterback, and he attends there. A little side note, this is a very funny story. One of our teenagers got real excited because she was there and she's been trying to meet Russell Wilson, and she finally met him, and she texted several people, including my daughter, hey, I just met Russell Wilson at church. I'm so excited. And Ashley texted her back. This is my daughter, Ashley. Texted her back and said, did you learn anything about Jesus? And without a thought, she said, yes, he answers prayers. I thought that was really clever. So, really interesting. So I'm there one night, and I go up to their worship team and say, hey, can I ask you guys about how you do worship? They gave me about 45 minutes of their time. This is a church that has the best musicians in Seattle, Washington, which is saying something, gathering, and they 100% of them volunteer. There's no paid staff at all for their worship team. They don't even get them strings and sticks. They pay for all their own gas, so strings, sticks, everything. The longest term has been doing it over 10 years. The drummer's been doing it 4 years, and he said there's no end in sight. He wakes up at 6 in the morning. He goes till about 10 p.m. every Sunday night for 4 years, and he looks forward to it. When he's on vacation, he goes through withdrawals. He loves doing it. Even though they'll play the same songs at every campus, they'll play them differently, and every campus requires 2 hours before worship, a 1 hour rehearsal, followed by a 1 hour we're visiting with people and the congregations are coming. Because here's something else I pick up from all these churches. People arrive early and they're excited to be there early. It is a quality and characteristic I see in all of them. Now, so they go through this whole thing where they're talking about worship. And what they do, this is really interesting that I'm starting to pick up. They do simple worship. The night we were there, they did 4 songs and a reprise after the sermon. So I went up and I said, is that normal? You do 4 songs and a reprise? And they said, no. It's very rare we do 4 songs. I was like, you know, thinking, you know, do you do 8 or 9? They said, no, we usually do 3 songs and a reprise. And they said, we do the 3 songs long enough that the non-believer and the non-church person or the new person can both learn and sing the song within the song.
And I was like, well, don't your churchgoers get bored with that? He said, we don't care about them. We're not here for the people that already know Jesus. We're here for the people who don't know Jesus. And we want them to be able to connect and worship. 100% they have to memorize their music. There are no music stands on their stage. And they say that's because musicians, whether they're playing or they're singing, need to be able to connect with the audience. There's never one person singing all the songs. That night they did four songs. They had four different lead vocalists. I couldn't tell which one was the lead in any of it. They're very good. Again, they donate all their time, and they provide for what I call big block preaching. Let's go back and let's understand some nuances that have happened. Baby boomers grow up in churches where they're hearing proof text preaching week after week after week. I grew up with 50-minute sermons, okay? And I'm not a baby boomer, so I know those of you a little bit older than me, you grew up really hearing super long sermons that sometimes were so disjointed. Then what happens is the baby boomers come along, and they're like, can we please have some graphics and some art, and can we liven things up? I mean, it's so serious. And when I left church, I don't know about you, but my experience was growing up, you left a 50-minute sermon, and one thing you were sure about is virtually no one at church or out of church had a chance of going to heaven. Right? It was in your face. You're not going to make it. You've got to change your life. It was there week after week after week hammering you. Baby boomers come on, they're like, where's the love? Where's the grace? Where's the joy? Where's the laughter? And so they begin to incorporate all that, and the pendulum swings, and guess where we're at now? Baby boomers started pushing for attention span theater preaching, a sitcom minus the commercials. So now baby boomer kids grow up hearing a sitcom minus the commercials, a lot of jokes, a lot of laughter, a lot of fun. And now, if you go to Reality LA, you go to City Church, you go to Ethos, you go to Mars Hill for sure, you go to Hillsong, you're going to hear a 40, 45-minute, 50-minute, some of them 65-minute expository teaching followed by preaching. Okay? Now, Dave Clayton, I typically notice he hits about 38 to 40 minutes, but they also edit out a lot of pastoral comments that are made. The same thing with Judah Smith. Mm-hmm. If you go listen to Judah Smith's sermons online, you'll notice that he preaches about 35 to 39 minutes. But if you're there live, you're aware before the recording started, he does some pastoral talking for about 5 to 7 minutes that they don't ever include on the podcast. Because they understand there needs to be some pastoral conversation that's there. The sermons are expository. They're very deep. They are challenging. They're not meant to be entertaining. They have some entertaining portions to them.
Yeah, one thing, too, that just speaking out of my generation, partly, of course, I said this yesterday, so those of you who aren't here, I'm not speaking for the whole generation because I'm not the whole generation, but I am in the generation. I can say we who are followers of Christ know this. Sometimes we struggle with this. Other times we really hit it well, is that Scripture rocks. There are moments I've never had when you're reading by yourself and you're like, oh my goodness, like Scripture really can enlighten my soul. I mean, there can be times when it can feel kind of boring, I guess, if you're like traveling through the wrong section, like Leviticus. But as long as you've got enlightening stuff, sometimes you need to be led that way. And what preachers nowadays are realizing is, hey, we're really wise. Mm-hmm. And we can really lead people into the beauty of Scripture. And so I can just remember my first time where I heard one of these sermons that went on for 40 minutes, and the whole 40 minutes was just trekking through great scriptural stuff. For the first time, I was feeling like I was hearing the gospel for the first time in my life, not because I'd never heard it before, but it was just, majority of the time, it was like a stand-up comedy show. Mm-hmm. And then the first time I hear just straight, this is like, I felt like I was in the moment with Jesus as he was dying, as he was being resurrected, and then tears are falling down my face, not because of the story and the person's life, though it connects to it, it was because I felt like I was actually hearing the story of the universe that we all know and love. So, I'm just saying, Scripture's amazing, and we've got to be sure it's not just like put here and there in our churches, but it's lived in. I mean, that's just for myself and my generation, I think, I'm really appreciating. It's when we just sit in Scripture and love it and say, hey, this is what we're all about. We're all about Him, and it goes through this, and we can understand it here.
5-6 weeks ago, Hillsong Worship in Manhattan gets done with their evening service, and the worship leader says, we're having too much fun. We're just going to keep going. And so for another hour, they do musical worship, and that's great. But all of these worship leaders will tell you, if you talk to them, what I heard at City Church. When we talk to non-believers, they say the most uncomfortable thing about church is sitting in a strange room with strange people singing strange songs. So they minimize the amount of music being forced on the audience in an effort to try to get the non-believers to stick. So they do more preaching comparative to music. It's just something you see in common with these that are being very effective. Another thing that I noticed that I'm a big fan of, we're not going to talk a lot about this, but the shared pulpit model, shared voices from the pulpit, is also a common denominator. You see this with Reality LA. You see it with City Church. I mean, Judah Smith is a phenomenal communicator, but he'll tell you that he preaches about 32 to 36 weeks out of the year and then incorporates his preaching team. Dave Clayton is using Brandon a lot right now, but now you guys are starting to bring up guys behind him?
Seven. Really, I'll preach him often.
Okay. The days of the single guy in the pulpit, except for when he's out of town on vacation, are done. And we need to be thinking in terms of how do we get the right voices in front of that audience. And this is something I was talking to a congregation recently about. Well, we don't have a lot of young people. Where would you find young voices? I said, there's a Christian college less than an hour from your campus. Drive over there and meet them. What is every young ministry major looking for? Opportunity. Give me some opportunity. Let me preach. Let me lead worship. Go get them, and you're their dream. We're going to give you an audience, and we're going to give you some critique. Now, you have to be willing to also critique. Unfiltered debate and the willingness to hear what we need to improve on. So let me use Caleb as an example. Caleb did the most disastrous thing you can do in Seattle ever at our church. He got up and he started his sermon with a great metaphor that began this way, and this was just a year and a half ago. He said, so the CEO of Microsoft, Bill Gates, walks in. Now, you can get away with that in 90% of humanity, except in Seattle, where they can tell you to the date and the month and how many years ago it was that Bill Gates said, I'm done with Microsoft, and walked away with his billions. So once he said that, about half of our audience was just on pins and needles to come up and say, do you know he's not the CEO? It was a great analogy, but it actually got woven in a little bit too much. So afterwards, he comes up to me and goes, okay, what'd you think? And I said, well, you need to ask yourself right now in this moment between first and second service, do you want to hear what I really think, or do you want me to tell you after second service? He opted for the former. So I sat down and said, here are some things you want to do. And he asked to be excused from the class time activities and went back to the office and came back and went from what I think I told you your first one was probably about a 4. And took it up to an 8.5, 9 on a scale of 1 to 10.
Yeah.
It rocked.
And also in your context, how often do you use it, or what's your time frame of preaching? You
can preach. About 35 to 38 minutes.
I just remember being way over, as in like
48 minutes. It was incredible.
Just kind of kept on talking. And so then that second
and time, I was going, yes, the young guy went long.
But the second time, because of all this critiquing, I remember coming in and nailing it. Just at least in time frame, not nailing the sermon.
No, you nailed the sermon too. It felt great. Okay, I'm bringing some things that we want to do Q&A, so if you have some questions, get them ready. Here's some other things you need to know. We talked about high trust. High trust, though, comes with high expectation.
Yes.
Talk about that real quick.
Yeah, so this comes into simplicity and trust. Yesterday I said, I was trying to form my thoughts on trust. I wanted to kind of come back to those. In our culture, trust means that we highly trust each other's capabilities. Have a high expectation on what you'll produce, but then trust that you'll produce it. So here's the example, is that, just a few weeks ago, we led our whole church to serve our city. And our biggest serving site, someone put me in charge of, And so it was to serve 400 homeless men with roughly 300 of our volunteers. And besides having done it 2 years prior and having all of the resources, I got nothing else. I'd been there last year. And he sat me down for an hour and said, hey, this is what I did, X, Y, and Z. Here's all the resources. Please let me know if you need anything else. You're going to do great. For
700 people.
Relatively large service initiative. And I mean, we pulled it off. It was fine. Not saying that's because I'm capable of it. It's because anyone's capable of it. They just need someone to say, hey, I believe in you. And I'm going to give you a chance. He also told me, hey, also if you fail, it's going to be okay. And I needed to hear that too, or else I probably would have been sweating bullets every day. But that's like the nature of this culture is, well, how are we going to elect all these people? Well, you give them that high expectation, hey, we want to pull this off, and I believe you can do it. That's at least what they told me, and I did it.
Another factor is the complexity of simplicity. Simple church is very complex because it requires a leadership that will look at loving Christians and say no. We don't do that. Andy Stanley says we do five things, right? We do children's ministry. We do student ministry. We do worship. We do small groups. And we do mission. Five things. Somebody comes in and says, but man, you know, you got 50, 60,000 people in your network. You could have a rockin' men's ministry. We do five things. And he'll go through it over and over and over. Saddleback Community Church, what they did is they got into the empowering Christians, where is God leading you? And this is a great thing to do, not putting it down. What does God get to you to do, empowering you to do? We want to encourage you to do it. About 3 years ago, they hired one of the originators of the multi-site concept to come as a full-time on-site consultant. Because they woke up one day and had 450 ministries on the ministries list with no clue of what most of them did. And all kinds of dysfunction relative to it. And so they had to hire a consultant to come in and work 2 to 3 years to simply go through and say, you've got to simplify what you're doing. You cannot do 450 things well. Even a church of 24, 26,000 with all the resources that Saddleback has, understand that simple church is pretty important. Some other shared observations. Get your questions ready. You have to have a way for people to get involved. So back to City Church. I said, if I were wanting to get involved in your worship ministry, how would I do that? They said, come on the first Thursday. What happens on the first Thursday? So we have 40 songs in our repertoire at any given time. And if Judah wants to add a new song, we ask him which song goes. It's a big decision. I said, why 40? They said, because we require every musician to memorize every piece in the key that the church sings it. I said, wait, what do you mean the key the church sings it? He said, we're not concerned about what the worship leader scheduled for that week can sing the song in. We're concerned about the key that the church can sing it in. We study the songs, and Paul Belosh is really big into this now. We study the songs, we understand what key our church sings it in best, and that's the key we'll sing it in. And if the leader says, but I can't lead it in that key, then you're not the leader for that song. We find the leader for that song. And so you're learning, you're memorizing, so that visually, every worship leader in here that's ever done any worship leading can tell you when they can set the songbook down, when they can set the charts aside and they can make eye contact while they're leading, there's a connection that takes place in worship that is powerful. And we need to understand that. So they said the first Thursday, if we're going to introduce a song, our best team, well, anybody can come that wants to be a musician. We come in the first 15 minutes. We say, here's the new song and the key. Here's how we want it done. Let's worship together. So they worship for about 15 minutes together. Then they divide you out. So you're a drummer, so we would send you with the percussion team. And they would assign you a mentor. And that mentor would job shadow you for a time at rehearsals, on weekly rehearsals. And they would say, first of all, you have enough skill, but it's not developed enough, so we're going to continue mentoring. Or a lot of the people that show up there, they say,
you know what? God bless you. This is not your gift. And they're frank with them. They'll let them know, this is not your gift. There are other things you should be doing. But if the mentor says, no, 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 you've got something here, they mentor you along for week after week or a week of rehearsal, then the mentor says, we're going to assign you to this campus for this service on this day. And the mentor will be with you there, in the case of a drummer, in the cage with the drummer. And at the end of the set, will evaluate and give feedback. And only at that point will they be considered to be made part of the worship team. Now, translate that in the a cappella world. You have an alto who everybody says, oh, she can sing. And the reason they sing is because she's like the loudest alto in the entire auditorium. In their system, they would assign that alto to a mentor that can do some volume control and help learn to harness that. And only at that juncture would that person be put up with a microphone. Okay? So these are things that are in common as well. And there's one other that we'll mention that we're going to do questions. All of these churches have no problem making a call to commitment. I'm blown away how many of these churches, they're being very effective. If you go to them, you say, I want to get involved in ministry, almost all of them, the first place you're going to start is in the parking lot. We'd love to sign you up to help greet people in the parking lot. If you're faithful doing that, then they'll move you in the foyer. If you're faithful doing that, then they start looking at other ministries. Now, here's the beauty of it. By the time you get moved into other ministries, what have you done? You've met tons of people. Now, what do they do at Ethos if I want to get involved? That's true for City Church. I know it's true for part of Reality Systems that they do. Ethos, if I said, hey, I want to get involved, what happens?
There's maybe a little bit less of that strictness. We have kind of six or seven, you say, ways of involvement or volunteering that are just easily, we need as many people as we can get. And what the kind of the notion is, when you have someone who's invested in their church, volunteering, they're going to become involved in more cases. So there are, in a way, serve ministries, I guess you could call it. Call whatever you want. There's greeting, and there's slides. There's coffee team. Help me out if I'm forgetting one.
There's cleanup.
Cleanup
and setup.
That's it. Mm-hmm. So very simple. When someone says, I want to get involved, there's a board that says, serve team. So all we say, we try to keep it simple, I want to get involved. And I said, well, sign up on this board team and we'll connect with you. We'll email you, and then that's what we do during the rest of the week. So we email them and say, hey, what do you want to do? When they say, hey, I want to do coffee team, we say, awesome. We'll sign you up for one Sunday a month for the next however long you commit, unless you have to go out of town or something. And then we wait till they show up that day to train them. So maybe the one that can make us most nervous would be slides.
Our kids team.
That's a good one. But slides, you're like, okay, when are you going to train them on slides? We just wait till they show up. So if it's someone's first time, then yeah, that takes a little bit of extra work because you have to show them. But how much more effective is it than to say, hey, why don't you show up 30 minutes early? Can you imagine doing that with everyone? I can't, and luckily we don't do that. We just wait till they show up, and then you just sit with them while all the worship happens and say, okay, you click next one. Oh, it's so simple, though. By the end of it, they are ready to show someone else. And then whoever was showing them is out of a job. They can go focus on something that matters more. It's ministry.
And one of the things Ethos does really well is they don't make things that are simple overcomplicated. You know, because you can do that with anything. Okay, questions. Any questions about Ethos or any of what we're talking about, please come up with at least three, or we'll just have dead time.
First, yeah.
I don't quite understand Ethos. You just pick a different location and meet, and how big do your groups get of people that gather on a regular basis?
Yeah, so we always started, it's not like we've had multiple at the beginning. We just started with one and then have found that we've been more effective, reaching the lost in more locations. But we have three in their fixed locations, so they don't move. Okay. Their worship, their music venues, we found that people who don't know Christ feel more comfortable going to a place that they might go the rest of the week. So there are music venues in Nashville. Those weren't hard to find. And the capacity is roughly 800 people on one of them, a little over 1,000 on another one, and only 100 people on the third one.
Right. Okay. So you do have
multiple
places, but a bigger number of people at the same time.
Yeah. And
participating, and yet you have a good leadership type. Okay, we've got this.
Yeah, yeah.
Are any of them video venue?
As in casted?
Yeah.
No, not at the moment, but that's not something that's out of the question. Right. I'm not fully against it, but trying to navigate that because multi-site gets kind of
another
crazy. Yeah.
Do you have, besides, okay, you have your younger people generationally speaking, do you have contact with the older churches and bodies where you both get together occasionally and participate in worship time, that type of stuff going on at the same time, that recognizing that I came from here, you're my brother, you're my sister, to where we are really working together and doing the same thing, glorifying God?
We just did that, actually. This past, where we did the Serving Our City,
right,
was with kind of our main contributing church, our parent church, the church that started Ethos. We served with them. We worshiped with them the weekend prior. And we served them the Wednesday prior to that serve.
So the people that do support you, per se, because, I mean, the way I vision it, my pea brain somewhat, is that whoever works is going to have support also at the same time, financially speaking. In other words, because it takes a lot of devotion, a lot of your time, anyone that's going to be a preacher, a teacher, these type of people, it takes them some financial support for them to get the devotion that they need to do in there. So these homes supporting congregations are supporting outside of their own little culture.
Ethos is pretty committed to every minister on staff, including Dave, has to raise part of their support outside the church. So they have that coming in, and that'll be an issue as they get bigger that they talked about quite a bit, because at one point you get large enough that you start thinking the other direction. So those are other questions. Good question, yeah.
I had a question to go back to the preaching.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned doing pastoral parts during the worship. Can you flesh that out a little more? What does that look like?
Yeah, vision casting. When I was at City Church, I became aware, I'd listen to the podcast after, and there's probably 7 or 8 minutes where Judah Smith, for example, is vision casting. Here's what's coming up. Here's what we're doing. It's not announcements. It's helping the church understand here's where we're going. Most of these congregations, if you listen to their podcast, they trim off vision casting stuff that's in-house church stuff. And so you got to be very careful of that. So maybe you're looking at, a 35-minute sermon, but if you were in the audience on that day, there could have been a 10-minute vision casting done either via video or live or all that kind of stuff. How do you guys vision cast at Ethos? Dave do that very often?
Yeah, a lot. And preaching will be the best time because people are just now engaged through through worship. They're fully ready to now listen to someone preach. And so the preacher gets up and says, hey, I'm going to start preaching in just a second, but real quick, I wanted to capture something that we're doing in 2 weeks. We're going to serve our city all over. And he just kind of explains it real quick. But he tries to be as quick and precise as he can because everyone's got their attention on him because they're ready to hear him preach. But the more you don't preach, the less people will pay attention. But he has everyone's attention for a solid couple minutes. And so he just gives them that, hey, this is what we're doing in a couple weeks. Kind of gives them that peace. Sometimes if there's a video, we make sure that the video is self-explanatory. So sometimes they'll get up and say, hey, in a second we're going to look in Mark, but real quick I want you to take a look at this video. So grab your Bibles and just look up the video. And
Ethos City Church, my experience, I've only been to Reality LA one in person one time, but I've listened to a lot of their stuff. They have very simple worship services. Give us an example of Ethos worship service.
When I say this too, I literally mean nothing else but 3 songs, the sermon, communion, 2 songs, ascending. And the ascending is 2 minutes. Sermon's about 30. The two or three songs before and after are averaging about 5 minutes each. And the communion kind of rolls into the first song, so they happen around the same time. So that eats up the same time.
And does the sermon sometimes roll straight into communion?
It always does.
It always does.
Yeah.
Right, Latin said. So it blends it. Very simple worship services. Same thing at City Church. Two songs and then an explanation of some missions to get involved in. Then they had another song. Then Judah Smith got up and preached. Then they had a reprise. Very, very simple worship and just packing it in with the text and the biblical stuff. Okay, we have time for one more question. Anybody else got a good one? Yeah.
I have a not good one.
Okay.
This may sound ignorant or superficial, but what about the lay leadership, what you talk about, like elders, deacons, that kind of structure, has become very board of trustees kind of feel, sometimes in churches. But I'm curious what that looks like or how that evolves.
As far as I understood, you for sure have a lot to say about this too, is that there's been maybe another cultural shift or understanding of, okay, what are the purposes of those elders? That can be, in a way, a hot topic, but it's something that always should be well understood, right? What is the purpose of an elder? And so Ethos doesn't have elders, I guess I should say first off, but that's because for two reasons. One, we're young, we're 6 years old, and two, we're young. Everyone in our church is pretty young, but we have older generation people coming in our church. But again, those older generation people in our church have only been in our church for a couple years. So they're discovering the culture just as strong as we are. So we need a couple years to understand, okay, what are we doing here? Where are we moving forward? So what we've been praying for and developing is, how can we see people that are full of wisdom, full of experience, who know the Lord and can pastor with a full heart, rise up in our church? So, that's what we're aiming for. And we're aiming for pastors, people who will, fully pastor and love on the leader and help in that way. Same language you guys know.
So the common term for this is polity model, your structural model. And the one that I'm just really starting to discover more and more, both in and outside my own system, is a lot of the churches that are really effective today are very large. And you ask the question, now, how do you have an effective elders meeting when you have, some of these churches have 110 elders. One of them does. Well, good grief. If the elders are going to decide everything, try to come to consensus with 110. So those churches all recognize that at some point we need a strategic leadership team made up of godly men and women that are helping strategically make the decisions wise, and the elders are empowering them to do that. And usually there's one or two elder representatives as part of that strategic team. And so they work to make the day-to-day decisions about where we're going, and the elder group may set policy. They may set a larger policy, like, when we are going to support a new missionary, here's our policy about that. We have to have X amount of years of track record. They have to, have shown effectiveness. They have to have this kind of relationship with the church. We have to be able to support them at X percentage. So the elders may set that overall guiding policy, but that strategic team is able to say, okay, this missionary fits it, and then the elders hold them accountable. Did you follow our policies? And that's it. That's really hard for our churches and Churches of Christ that are largely elder-led. But many of you know that people outside the Church of Christ that are pretty smart leaders have studied Church of Christ model, and they have said, your model is what caps you. It's your leadership model is what prevents you from really being dynamic. And I can tell you that. You get more than 8 people around a strategic team to come up to decision, you spend hours debating things that shouldn't be debated when you can move quickly at the speed of trust. And so over and over I'm seeing strategic teams developed of 6, 7, or 8. I've not seen a single one with more than 8 people. Some of them will choose 7. Why? Yeah, in case you actually have to vote, but most of them go for consensus. Most of them are going for consensus, and they have godly pastoral staff and a couple of the elders
on those teams to make those decisions. And there's some things about that. I can tell you this. If you do that, here's for our system in the Churches of Christ is the must. Let's say you have 10 elders and two of the elders are going to be on the strategic team. Those two elders must represent the full voice of the eldership, and the other eight elders must implicitly trust for whatever time they're appointed those two elders on the strategic team. That means you have to set up like annually or every other year. We're going to evaluate how well those elders did representing the full eldership.
For the same token, yeah. as a leader of the church, you need to be good at it.
Yeah.
And you don't take an elder or shepherd per se and put him in a strategy if he's not any good at it.
Yeah. Hard to believe that some elders just aren't good at everything, right? Pastors, none of us are good at everything. And so you got to do it. God bless. We're past time. Thanks for coming and being part of this. 9 o'clock's a late night, but hopefully the conversation's